Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The White House this week unveiled an expansive series of reports on the crypto industry, which is made up of digital assets and servers and crypto mines that seemed kind of silly about a decade ago, but have since mushroomed into a full-blown thing we all apparently have to start thinking about. The reports were asked for by an executive order back in March of this year and hinted at some form of future regulatory structure for crypto and also inched forward toward the creation of a dollar-backed digital currency. Now, for me, I've always placed crypto somewhere between pointless and a scam, and that's setting aside the energy and carbon side of it. But it really doesn't seem like it's going away, and ignoring it doesn't seem to be the best approach. Ben McKenzie is a writer, an actor, and a director, and has been one of the leading voices among crypto skeptics out there. This summer for The Intercept, along with Jacob Silverman, he filed a deeply disturbing dispatch on the world of crypto in El Salvador, headlined, "Nayib Bukele's Broken Bitcoin Promise. El Salvador's embrace of Bitcoin didn't bring prosperity. It rode in with waves of repression." He's also writing a book about crypto and fraud with Jacob called Easy Money, which will be published by Abrams Press in 2023. Ben is cursed, or perhaps blessed, depending on how you see it, to be known most places he goes as Ryan from the OC, but hopefully by now he's at least equally appreciated for his crypto work. And Ben, thanks so much for joining me, and welcome to Deconstructed.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you for having me. Great intro.
And so before we get to the White House announcement, let's talk first about your El Salvador piece. But most of it is pretty brutal, but there's also this one funny moment I wanted to read from you. So you and Jacob wrote, "Attempts to contact the president via his preferred medium, Twitter, were unsuccessful, except in causing a minor Salvadoran social media flurry that an actor from the TV show Gotham was in town." So did you ever hear from anybody inside the Bukele circle whether he saw that bat signal that you tried to put out?
We never heard anything, and it was quite funny. We had a lot of different contacts were given to us in his administration. We reached out to, I want to say, at least half a dozen. Nobody took us up on the offer. And to make matters worse, you know, so I'm here. I played a young Commissioner Gordon on a TV show called Gotham. And Nayib Bukele, the president of El Salvador, fancies himself as a Batman. He loves
he's the vigilante.
The comics, and he's the vigilante. He's the tough guy. He's rooting out crime. And so I tweeted at him from inside his country to no avail, even though we know, or we can certainly imagine, that he was probably glued to Twitter. Mm-hmm. Actually, at that very moment, because some pretty shocking allegations had come out from El Faro, the local opposition newspaper, had released some audio recordings of members of his administration who had basically cut a deal with the gangs in order to stave off gang violence, which is a big problem in El Salvador. They had, you know, cut a deal and said, if you don't, you know, mess with each other, then we'll leave you be. That gang violence had re-erupted in the spring, which had caused Bukele to administer martial law, which is where we found the country when we visited there in the spring. But anyway, the worst of it all was that Nayib is a total celebrity. He's a lover of celebrities. He had just met with Daniel Baldwin. There was a whole to-do. They actually called a press conference for him to meet with the Baldwin brother that you never knew existed, Daniel Baldwin.
I'd never heard of him until you mentioned it.
Yeah. I tried not to take it personally, but you know what? He probably didn't want to talk to me because I'd have some tough questions for him, I think.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, a friend of mine at a party once that had a bunch of celebrities, because it was like around Obama's inauguration, was asked if he was a celebrity. And he mentioned a Baldwin. He made up a Baldwin name. And they all took a picture with him. Because nobody's going to question you if you just say a name and a Baldwin. But so, you know, for those listeners who don't know, Bukele calls himself the, quote, cool dictator. And he officially adopted crypto in El Salvador basically on the day, correct me if I'm wrong, basically on the day that it completely blew up.
Yeah.
what did you learn about the crypto uptake in and how people in El Salvador are adopting it?
Right. So they're not, is the short answer. In June of 2021, Bukele, with sort of out of nowhere, announced that El Salvador, this small mountainous country lacking in natural resources and quite poor, the average Salvadoran makes about $300 a month, was suddenly going to adopt Bitcoin as legal tender in September, so only 3 months later. This was quite a surprise to, you know, the world, but also to Salvadorans themselves. And the marketing pitch was quite, you know, it was an interesting marketing pitch, because on the face of it, maybe this could work, right? El Salvador's economy is heavily dependent on remittances. About a quarter of the economy, 24%, is the 2 to 3 million Salvadorans who live in the United States who send money back home. And if you could use Bitcoin rather than traditional means, Western Union, MoneyGram, then theoretically, this could boost government coffers. It could theoretically reduce transaction costs for the customers. Could be a win-win, could be a game changer, right? But like everything in crypto, things did not go according to plan. And effectively, as we find ourselves here, no one is using cryptocurrency, almost no one in El Salvador. Government-owned figures have shown that less than 2% of remittances are using the Chivo wallet system that they set up. There's a number of reasons for that, but one of them is that the system doesn't work very well. They built a system on top of Bitcoin. And another is that the people don't trust the government to make things work very well. Bukele himself is popular, but people would rather go with the things that they've relied upon, Western Union, MoneyGram, traditional services, even paying the larger fees, so that the thing works, first of all, you're not ripped off, and you're not exposed to the volatility of the underlying cryptocurrencies themselves. And I think that's really such a shining example of rubber hitting road here. You know, these cryptocurrencies are not actually currencies by any reasonable economic definition. They're a poor medium of exchange, unit of account, and store of value. Those are the three functions of money that economists look for when they look for a reasonable currency. They're really much more similar to unregistered and licensed securities. They're investments of money in a common enterprise with the expectation of profit to be derived from the efforts of others. That's the definition of a security under American law, under what's called the Howey test. Mm-hmm. And they're being sold in these, you know, unregulated marketplaces. So the propensity towards fraud is just sort of undeniable. And it's really kind of a sad thing that it got adopted by a country that could ill afford to spend the hundreds of millions of dollars that they spent to roll out this disastrous program.
Securities, though, in general, represent shares in a thing, like in a thing that produces something of value. You could debate the amount of the value, but usually it's a company that produces something. And so this feels more like these kind of mafia companies that don't actually make anything, and then they have a stock that a bunch of stockbrokers sell that then drives the price up, then they all dump it on the market.
Yep.
And move on to the next thing. What's the difference between a classic mafia pump and dump scheme and this?
There's not much. There really isn't. I mean, you hit it right, you hit the nail right on the head. It's air. It's securitized air. They securitized, in an unlicensed and unregistered way, some bits of computer code that people are sending back and forth to each other on these things called blockchains. And a blockchain, for all its, you know, supposedly innovative nature, is not innovative, really. It's 30 years old. Blockchains have been around since 1991. Stuart Haber and Scott Stornetta at Bell Labs came up with a way of creating a way of storing information in blocks that can be added to rather and never subtracted from. The reason that blockchain has not taken off outside of crypto is that it doesn't really work very well. And the computer scientists that Jacob and I have spoken to on the book, you know, are extremely dismissive of this. So you're absolutely right. What they're really doing is they're telling a story. Robert Shiller, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, has spoken about this, I think, quite well. He's talked about how economic narratives form. And the narratives come from somewhere. In the case of crypto, the genesis, I would say, is the subprime crisis. which created a lot of distrust of financial intermediaries and banks and the financial system, for good reason, you might say. They utterly failed us. And so that energy was directed, you know, you could say on the left it was directed towards Occupy, and on the right it was the Tea Party. But in terms of the cypherpunks, this was directed towards creating this trust, quote-unquote, trustless currency. Well, it didn't work as a currency, but eventually it sort of worked as this thing that you could gamble on. Mm-hmm. And you could create all these other currencies, quote-unquote currencies, that, again, you don't know who owns the majority of these quote-unquote coins. You don't know what they're doing to inflate the value of those coins. There's a lot of what's called wash trading going on in crypto, where you basically trade the coins back and forth amongst accounts you control to inflate the value, to make it look like there's a market. And then, you know, once you've gotten real people in, regular real money in, then you dump and you cash out into real money. That's happening an awful lot. And that's why you're seeing arrests, you know, almost by the day.
And so when the crypto world blew up around the time that Bukele was adopting it, there was a thing called a stable coin that completely collapsed, which I found kind of amusing. Well, not amusing for the people who lost their shirts, but what is a stable coin? That if somebody told me that they were selling me a stable coin, that would be my first kind of indication to go away. Like, why are you calling this a stable coin? What's so stable about it that you need to put stable right in the name? So what's the difference?
Such a good point, Ryan. I mean, one of the rules of thumb I've discovered in crypto is everything is the opposite of what it purports to be, right? Currencies are not currencies. Stable coins are not stable. Centralized means centralized. There, you could even combine them together, these meaningless words, to create meaningless phrases, like some absurdist attempt at German. There are things called DAOs, which are supposedly decentralized autonomous organizations. Well, they're neither decentralized nor autonomous nor particularly organized. they're a mess. And so there's a joke of the skeptic community that basically crypto is speed running the last half a millennia of financial mistakes, right? It's all the stuff that we've tried that just hasn't worked. And so your question is, why does it keep going? And the answer is, it's not working for the vast majority of people, right? Like the vast majority have lost money, but it's working for somebody. And so you have to ask, well, who's it working for, right? The people that issue the coins, the people that run the exchanges, the marketing companies that get the marketing dollars in, the celebrities who benefit. But the poor guys holding the bag here are the retail customers who have gone into the casino thinking they're going to get rich, and instead they lose all their money. Sorry, I didn't answer the stablecoin question. I'd be happy.
Yeah, what do they pretend to mean by stablecoin?
Sure. So a stablecoin is theoretically a coin tied to a regular currency, an actual currency. So in the case of El Salvador, the stablecoin that's really in question there is a company called Tether. One Tether is theoretically worth $1, and you should ask yourself, why is that necessary in crypto? Well, once you've entered the casino and you've bought a bunch of crypto, you probably want to stay in the casino for as long as they can, as long as you're winning. Because to come out of the casino and to transfer back into real money, you're going to trigger a taxable event. You're going to have to go through a bank account. And so you want something that you can go in and out of in between your speculative plays on the price of this or that crypto going up or down. But you don't want to be exposed to the volatility of crypto itself. Mm-hmm. So you're sort of Secretary Gensler of the SEC calls them the poker chips of the casino. And I think that's right. That's the correct metaphor. The majority of the transaction volume in crypto is actually conducted in stable coins. It's people kind of gambling with these chips and using them to also, I would argue, most likely manipulate the price of the other cryptocurrencies. Mm-hmm. And they're run by, in the case of Tether, who, by the way, Tether and the people that are behind Tether have allegedly been very involved in trying to reformulate El Salvador's security laws.
And Bukele said as much, right?
That's right. And so these guys are they're going to be featured in the book. They're pretty, they're an amusing group. You're talking about a company that has 12 employees, according to LinkedIn, that was once worth $80 billion on paper. So I think it's now 60-something. So they've got a dozen employees. They're worth $60 billion. They have fewer employees than my neighborhood deli. And they're running a $60 billion company. And it's awfully hard not to look at them and say, well, they got a money printer, right? They got this thing that in the casinos, the crypto casinos, is supposedly worth a dollar, but how much real money's actually backing that?
So they make the chips.
They make the chips, but your question is, you know, a chip is just a piece of plastic, right? In this case, it's a piece of code. What's the real asset backing it, right? And, you know, if you want to go into detail here, one of the big tells of Tether, in my opinion, is the way they control the redemption process. When you're running a Ponzi scheme, one of the things that you really need to do is make sure that people are not trying to all get their money out at the same time, because it's not there. So when you try to get your money out, the whole thing falls apart. You know, it's what took down Madoff, was the subprime crisis. When the markets crashed, everyone tried to get their money out, only to discover that it wasn't there.
That's when hedge funds run into trouble, too.
That's right.
When they start to pause redemptions. Everybody's like, oh, wait, why are you doing that?
That's right. And they're using leverage. And leverage is used in all sorts of, you know, mainstream financial products and things like hedge funds. But when you're actually running a Ponzi, when there really isn't a product there to begin with, that's when you get into real trouble. What Tether does is, and this is on their website, you can look this up, that you are not allowed to redeem Tethers for less than $100,000. They just won't even engage with you. So Tethers are being traded on the casino floor amongst participants, and the casinos keep a certain amount of liquidity there so they can go in and out. But the real money, the people that have bought Tethers in the billions, a lot of them have exited their positions. So the question is, what happens if and when Tether falls apart, which admittedly has been the boogeyman for a long time of crypto skeptics. We've thought that Tether had to settle with the New York Attorney General in early 2021 and agree not to do business in New York, the financial center of the world, which would seem to be a a bad sign if you're running a supposedly revolutionary technology stablecoin company. They had to settle and they had to agree to quarterly attestations, but the company itself has never been audited. And I think that's just a big red flag. They've got some guys who have sketchy pasts. And, you know, you could make a plausible argument they're running a counterfeit dollar operation.
What's their response been to skeptics like yourself who've made this criticism of them? Because typically in the financial world, if you issue an analysis that's this blunt about a firm, you're going to hear from lawyers. You're going to get threatened with lawsuits. How dare you make these claims about us? Do they ever do that? And what has generally been their response to the kind of suggestion that there's not a whole lot of difference here between a Ponzi scheme and what's going on, or the chips in the casino, or Gensler's points?
Yeah, I have to say it's been quite shocking to me. I'm the son of a lawyer. I would have thought that Jacob and I would have been, if not sued, I would have assumed we would have been criticized and there would have been some threats made. We wrote this article for the Washington Post on Binance, which is the largest crypto exchange in the world. And, you know, in there were some pretty startling facts about the massive conflicts of interest in Binance and the way that Binance had failed to just shut down at several points in 2021 as the price of crypto collapsed. All of a sudden couldn't get your money out, which again goes back to redemptions. And tells of a Ponzi, and there's no pushback. I mean, we asked for, you know, there were no clarifications. There was nothing. In fact, they're trying to, you know, talk to us to explain their side of the case. I think what's happening, I mean, if you looked at it from a legal perspective, I'm not a lawyer, but these are companies that are not domiciled in the United States. The volume in crypto runs through offshore exchanges. In the case of Binance, they famously don't have a headquarters. There is no Binance headquarters, which is pretty remarkable, right? They're run through these shell corporations in the Caribbean. And same with Tether. I think they were banked at Deltac in the Bahamas or somewhere. So, you know, my guess as to why we haven't been sued is, I mean, I can't speculate as to whether we're right or wrong, but they probably don't want to you know, I mean, if you sue us in American court, you're going to have a discovery process, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's interesting. I'm surprised there hasn't been more pushback, but yeah, I can't speak to their motivations.
So in the White House reports that came out this week, a lot of it seemed to be pretty vague, gesturing in a variety of different directions. But one of the few things that was a little bit less vague was a suggestion that, okay, maybe the U.S. ought to create a U.S. digital currency. And I'm curious what that means, because to me, I don't quite understand why, like, what I have in my, you know, bank account app is not a digital currency, because, you know, I can move it digitally from my checking account to my savings account from my checking account. I can, you know, use it to pay for things digitally. Obviously, though, there's something different because they're talking about creating it and they're getting all of these, you know, different agencies and smart people together to do it. So what would be the difference between a U.S. digital currency and the currency that we currently have that we can move around digitally?
On one level, there isn't much difference. You're right. We one of the sort of amusing things about cryptocurrency is that you needed to create digital dollars to begin with. I mean, the vast majority of our dollars are not physical hard currency, obviously. They're just, you know, numbers in bank accounts, databases in bank accounts. And so on that level, there isn't much difference. There are, however, some potential gains to be had, arguably, by creating basically sort of cutting out the middleman in terms of the banking system and allowing the Fed to, each of us to have our own account at the Fed that, for example, imagine there's another pandemic and the Fed needs to issue stimulus checks. Well, if everybody has their own account, they can do that immediately, right, with a click of a button. And you save all this time, this effort, and you have an immediate economic impact. And I think, you know, economists and central bank people get all excited about the potential advantages there, because, of course, a lot of people don't. You know, we do have a problem of banking the unbanked in this country. A lot of people who don't have access to bank accounts are getting screwed over by payday lenders and things like that. So you could, you know, there's potential savings there. What's fascinating about the central bank digital currency proposals, which are still, I would argue, in their nascent stages, I don't think they've really, in America, I don't think it's really gotten that advanced that I'm aware of, is that they're not based on blockchain. They're not based on, right? They have nothing to do with blockchain because blockchain doesn't work, right? So it's very funny, you know, when crypto was in its heyday only a year ago, you would have a lot of conflation, a purposeful conflation of like, look, you know, there's this rumor that, you know, the U.S. is going to go to a digital currency. That's going to be great for crypto. Well, no, obviously not. Because if the thing that you say you're making, this supposed digital currency, which is in fact not a currency, if it's replaced by the Fed issuing it, then your business model is destroyed. I mean, to be blunt, you're, there's no reason for you to exist. But it's all kind of a bit of smoke and mirrors, because what the Fed is really doing right now, as far as I can tell, is there. Let me see, I've marked it. I'll just read from the statement.
Sure.
Quote, to make payments more efficient, the Federal Reserve has planned the 2023 launch of FedNow, an instantaneous 24/7 interbank clearing system that will further advance nationwide infrastructure for the instant payments alongside the clearinghouse's real-time payment system. So they're working on sort of like the plumbing of our banking and clearinghouse system. That's not sexy. It's not interesting. It doesn't really have much to do with retail regular folks' everyday experience. But I think that there are advances that can you know that are on the horizon there. Other countries are trying this kind of stuff. Brazil's trying it. India. But ironically or amusingly enough, you know, this has nothing to do with blockchain, and none of them are using blockchain. So unfortunately, crypto is most likely going the way of the dodo bird.
Does that mean that because they're not using blockchain, it wouldn't be as energy intensive? What is it about crypto that makes it is the blockchain that makes it so bizarrely energy intensive?
It's the proof of work concept that is tied to Bitcoin itself. So proof of work is in order to basically, you're trying to run a system, a quote unquote trustless system, which is a whole other topic we could talk about, because you can't create, from economists, it's very funny, because you can't create a trustless money because money is trust.
Right.
you know, we made up money. There's a great book, Money, by Jacob Goldstein, who is a one of the hosts of Planet Money. And in his book, Jacob writes, the thing that makes money money is trust. You know, it's we made it up. So creating, you know, replacing it with the computer code is sort of it's a story. It's an interesting story. It's not a true story. What proof of work is in order for us to run this system where we don't have to trust each other, we're all gonna, you know, validate each other. We're all gonna run these computers that are gonna sort of constantly check each other and make sure that the blockchain is accurate. And in order to incentivize people to validate those transactions, if they guess correctly, these computers run 24/7 and they guess at random numbers and letters. And if they guess correctly, they get Bitcoin. They mine a new Bitcoin and they get the money that's associated with it. It's not a very smart system, to be blunt. I mean, I went to the largest crypto mine in America, which is outside of my hometown of Austin, in March of this year. It's called the Windstone Facility. And it's a former Alcoa aluminum smelting plant that has now devoted to mining Bitcoin, where they just run these warehouses of computers. And they burn an enormous...
Just banks of servers?
Yeah, it's crazy, man. And they use... So in 2021, Bitcoin used the energy equivalent of Argentina. And the greenhouse gas, is the estimated greenhouse gas used to consume that electricity, that energy, was it more than offset the electric vehicle savings that we had done, that we had accumulated globally for that year. So it's ridiculous. You're running this tiny little program, which actually has quite few users. Crypto is actually quite small in terms of people who are actually trying to transact in it. And the cost is massive. And you're not getting anything out of it. Again, Bitcoin can only process only 5 to 7 transactions a second. Visa can do 24,000. So when you talk to computer scientists, they just tear their hair out. They just scream, almost literally scream in agony, like, this doesn't work. Stop trying to make this work. You can switch from proof of work to what's called proof of stake, which is what Ethereum is doing, this thing called the Ethereum merge. But that then makes it awfully clear that you're running a security, because that's basically a proof of stake is basically like the people that have stake in it, that own a bunch of the Ethereum, they're controlling, you know, what to do with the network. So that sounds like a share of a stock,
right,
to me, and to the government, by the way. I think the SEC has already sort of hinted that that's going to be coming. So the whole thing kind of collapses in on itself, because again, there's nothing new under the sun. They're just taking money from people, speculating on it. And unfortunately, in this case, the casino is unregulated, so most folks are going to lose.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if we've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So when I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are just $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, I thought, what's the catch? But after talking to them, it all made sense. There isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. They cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings directly to you. With Mint Mobile, you save money and get quality service. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/deconstructed. That's mintmobile.com/deconstructed. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/deconstructed. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabyte on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
And now, one of the things that governments don't like about crypto is that it has been used, you know, on the black market. And in there are cases where I think that's actually a good thing. Like in general, I kind of think that it'd be nice if people have some way of getting around government surveillance to a point. Is there any way that people could create some type of asset that can get around government surveillance without it becoming one of these Ponzi schemes?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And we do hear about that. We hear about people using it basically because they've run out of better options, right?
Right.
I mean, folks using it in Afghanistan. There's an article about folks using it in Argentina where there's hyperinflation or massive levels of inflation. I don't know if it's technically hyperinflation yet. But, you know, places where the currency or the banking system, in the case of Afghanistan, is just not working, right? And the trick there is that it's difficult to come up with an alternate payment method that can't be used by the bad guys just as much as it can be used by the good guys. And quite frankly, the bad guys often have more money to try to launder and move around. So it's one of those really difficult and perplexing questions. You know, I would say if you're not trying to send it overseas, the original way of doing this is cash, right?
Right.
I mean, that's the way you do it, you know, for all the folks that are here in America and trying to, you know, give folks that work for you a little tip or do this or that is like, you know, you give them some cash. And I don't knock that. I actually think that's sort of like a good, you know, kind of good, well, I shouldn't say it's a good workaround, but it's a way, it's the time-honored workaround. The problem is sending it internationally. I don't know how you do it. The worry here that I have in terms of folks being paid in crypto is the volatility of the price, but also that when it comes to a company like Tether, at some point that company might fail. That company might crash because it doesn't actually, it might not have the reserves that it says it has. If that happens, all hell breaks loose and, you know, they can't get any of their money out. And so there's a real, you know, counterparty risk there that I think is significant and not to be discounted. So I think folks use it when they have to. And I don't begrudge people that pay others in crypto. We've heard from a lot of different people in a lot of different circumstances. That's really their only way of doing it. But it'll be painful if it crashes even further and wipes people out.
And I started the show by saying that we can't really ignore this any longer. But is that true? Like it sounds like on some level that maybe this might just crash and burn and work itself out.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's the question that I keep going back over and over again. I was talking to an economist yesterday, and we were arguing about it. I don't know, of course. No one knows the future. I'm skeptical, but then again, that's my that's my forte, I guess. I think that you have to separate out, as we've been talking about, digital currencies and their future from blockchain. So when you talk about blockchain, I think blockchain will probably not, it won't disappear, but its uses will be confined to small systems where you would want to create an immutable ledger that could track, you know, the economist I was talking to was talking about memorabilia, you know, Pokemon cards. You could create a blockchain for Pokemon cards and people could trade them back and forth. Okay, sure. I got nothing against blockchain, by the way. It's just,
right.
It's just a ledger. I can't be mad at a ledger. What I'm mad about is the potential fraud behind the markets these days. So blockchain will probably be around in some limited way, is my guess. Digital currencies probably are the future. We're probably a little bit away from really honing those and figuring those out. And there's some experimentation going on. But my guess is that, yeah, that'll that there's potentially large savings in intermediaries and cutting, actually, in a weird way, sort of addressing the initial issue of crypto, trying to cut out the middleman. The problem is that they cut out the middleman between the thing that they hate the most, the Fed, the central authority, and the actual consumer. So that's my guess as to where it's going. But let's see. We'll see. Once the fraud washes out and these things are classified as securities, I'd be very curious to see what's left in terms of the current quote-unquote cryptocurrencies.
What happened to NFTs? They go away? They still around? Like, they were everywhere for like 2 weeks.
Yeah. So NFTs were these fascinating things that for economists are just total head scratchers. Like, what? I mean, cryptocurrencies are bad enough, but in it, you're buying a quote non-fungible token, which, as far as I can tell, is basically a receipt for a JPEG. It's like, hey, I bought this thing. Let me show you. It's on a blockchain. And you can right-click and save a JPEG. You don't need to, you know, buy it for millions of dollars worth of cryptocurrency. So it was hard not to see that. It is still hard for me not to see that. It's just pure speculation. Somebody's gone in. They've accrued a bunch of crypto, and they want to make even more crypto. And so they gamble on it, and there's some status games going on. You know, it's like, oh, I paid a bunch of money for this NFT that the celebrity was hawking. But when you get into the plumbing of them, the wash trading in the NFT marketplace was off the charts. I mean, it was, I read something said 99%. Some study had 99% wash trading, which meant...
That means just people moving NFTs back and forth between accounts.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so wash trading is like you're just selling it back and forth to accounts that you control, making it look like there's a real marketplace, but there isn't one. And so my suspicion is that sort of what happened is that it was even more filled with air. And as soon as crypto itself started crashing and people actually needed to get back out into real money, they're no longer speculating on NFTs, and it's the most bubblicious of all the bubbles. It pops the first. And NFTs are really fascinating because they don't even, in my understanding, they aren't really even the digital art itself, which I think can be interesting. Sometimes it's gauche, sometimes it's interesting. But you're buying this thing, which is sort of like a link to a URL. It's like a little it's a receipt. It's a very weird thing. And I think folks are going to realize pretty quickly that they may have lost all their money in that regard.
The other selling point of this, people talk about the security of it all, yet I keep seeing people getting ripped off and robbed, and somebody stole their frogs or whatever. Somebody stole their NFTs. Somebody stole their Bitcoin. Like how do they keep getting their pockets picked if this is the most secure system that they can develop?
Exactly. I mean, for a supposedly decentralized system, there's a hell of a lot of different protocols, and you got to do this, and you got to go through this person and do, you know, this intermediary. And at every juncture, because it's unregulated, there's not only nothing stopping people from ripping you off, there's also almost arguably very little even disincentivizing you from ripping you off. Like, why not rip you off, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that goes back to just faulty philosophy here. That you could create this money that's trustless and a system where you didn't need to trust anybody. You just had to trust the code, so to speak. Well, code doesn't fall from the sky. Code is written by people who are running companies, right? That are trying to make money. How are they making money? Well, you know, they want to sell their coin, and they want their coin to be valued and this, that, and the other. But to your point from a while back, like, what's separating what they're doing from penny stock fraud from the 80s or you know, microcap from the 90s? I mean, people just inflating some security and then cashing out. They look awfully similar. And I think in crypto, you know, you just have to question, are we really going to keep doing this where people are just going to get ripped off? If you talk to folks in crypto, and I did walking around South by Southwest and the Bitcoin conference in Miami, which is the biggest Bitcoin conference in the world, and I would ask folks about people who've lost their money due to scams. And one of the first people I asked, he goes, oh, well, you know, I've been scammed. And I was like, what? He's like, yeah. You know, I had to learn, I had to do my own research. It was a learning experience. And then I asked the next person. He got scammed as well. And I swear to God, almost everybody I talked to in crypto has been scammed at one point. It's sort of a badge of honor. It's like, yeah, I didn't learn this or that or the other, and now I know, and now I'm better. But, you know, you gotta do your own research. You gotta learn. It's fascinating to study from, you know, the psychology of it, because it really smacks a lot of a multi-level marketing scheme where the system can't fail. You can only fail the system, right? Like it's not that the MLM that you work for isn't a good MLM. It's that you didn't sell enough of it. Mm-hmm. You didn't, you know, do it correctly. And it's sort of similar with that, right? But when you go down underneath it, you go, well, wait a minute, you know, if you got scammed and you work in crypto, you're a guy who devotes your entire life to it, seemingly, then what hope do the rest of us have? And isn't money supposed to be easy? Isn't the whole idea right. of money that it's supposed to be convenient and accessible and usable? I think it really does get to the heart of the matter.
Like, we wouldn't really tolerate that with online banking. Like, I opened up a SunTrust account and they took my money, but you know, then I realized that I had, you know, not checked the right box. And so the next time I opened up a SunTrust account, they didn't steal my money. I'd be like, no, like...
Exactly.
And I can't steal my money.
Exactly. And why? Why do you know when you put your money in a bank, a licensed bank in the United States, why do you know your money's good? Because of regulation. Because of the FDIC program, right? The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which has been around since the 30s, since we created securities laws in this country, which, you know, was all, in some sense, a reaction to the lack of securities laws and the lack of a thing like the FDIC in the 20s and the roaring 20s and the crash and the Great Depression, all that stuff. The FDIC, you know, guarantees your bank account up to a certain amount. And so you know your money's good, and no one has ever lost a penny of an FDIC insured bank account since it came into being. So how does it work? Well, the banks, in order to get that FDIC license, have to follow a whole host of regulations, right? They have to like comply with a whole bunch of stuff. Now, is the system perfect? Hell no, right? I mean, you saw in the subprime crisis, you saw the SNL, the savings and loan crisis, you know, you see these banks have all sorts of problems, but at least there's regulations, and the government's saying in exchange for following the regulations, we're your backstop. We'll make sure that everyone knows their money's good. That is a way of creating trust, right? Trust through proven experience, right? Through a track record. That's how it works, right? You don't just create trust out of thin air by saying, oh, it's code. It's like, you know, it just doesn't work that way.
And the White House report kind of waves at the possibility that the CFTC, I guess the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, would be might end up being the place that regulates them. I think it already regulates some elements or futures tied to crypto or something. Does that seem right to you, or do you think it ought to be the SEC, since you're talking about these things as securities? But if they're securities, are they illegal securities because they don't actually produce, they don't actually make anything?
Exactly. So what government agency is in charge of regulating Ponzi schemes?
Is it the FTC? Take a guess. Are they illegal?
No. I mean, you're talking about securities. Right. Well, so they're FBI? Illegal. They're illegal. So they're secure. So they're securities that have no product, right? They're a Ponzi scheme. They're nothing actually. Banoff didn't actually make the trades or didn't make a fraction of the trade. So what do you think it is? Who's in charge of Ponzi schemes? I'll answer for it. The SEC is in charge of Ponzi schemes. If you go to the SEC's website, there is a page, the seven tells of Ponzi schemes, seven warning flags of Ponzi schemes. If you look at crypto, I think it checks off like five or six of the seven.
Right off the bat.
So, you know, look, as you can probably tell, I would like the SEC to be in charge. The CFTC would really like to be in charge. There's a whole, you know, inner turmoil there as they're sort of battling over jurisdiction. And Bitcoin has been classified as a commodity. And it's a very strange case. We'll go into it in the book, but it's super boring. And I won't bore you with it now. But the 20,000 other cryptocurrencies that currently exist sure as hell look like securities to me. And the other thing I'll say here is the real risk of putting the CFTC in charge is that you're looking at potentially a lot of regulatory capture. The CFTC has the budget. I think it's like a fifth the budget of the SEC, or a sixth or something like that. And you see crypto really cozying up to the CFTC. One of the commissioners of the CFTC did a selfie with one of the big crypto players. Actually, she just did another one. Maybe it's a selfie, but a picture with the guys that she's supposedly regulating. She had deleted the first one. The next one, the last one's up. You know, the SEC has always had trouble being taken seriously. It's often mocked, ridiculed for being ineffective. But if you want a really potentially ineffective regulatory body, the CFTC with a fraction of the budget, you know, might be an even better choice. So all I really care about is the average Joe not getting swindled here. The thing with the SEC and CFTC, they're not the DOJ. They're not going to charge people with crimes they go to jail for. They can fine people. They can refer cases to the DOJ. But at some point, and the DOJ has got its hands full at the moment, of course, at some point, you know, or I'd hope for some folks to actually go to jail and committed crimes, be charged with those crimes, because that's where I think you'll really see the sort of house of cards collapse. In the last bubble of crypto during what's called the ICO craze, the initial coin offering craze, that I think was really what helped bring down the house, was the DOJ getting involved and actually saying, all right, you know, you guys have committed, you know, wire fraud, tax fraud, bank fraud, whatever it is, and, you know, you're actually going to go to jail. And that spooks everybody, and they kind of cut it out. So hopefully something like that's coming.
And you said 20,000 currencies?
Yeah, it's more. If you think of them as securities, here's a fun little fact for you. If you think of them as securities, that's more than all the securities in the major U.S. stock markets. Like, it sets all the securities listed on NASDAQ and New York Stock Exchange combined. Isn't that fascinating? I thought they sort of...
So they're just popping up new securities constantly?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and so you don't know. And so why do we have securities laws? We have securities laws because of disclosure, right? And primarily. When you're giving your money, when you're investing in something, you're giving your money over to someone, you need to know who the hell's taking your money and what the hell they're doing with it, right? And so the SEC has all of these rules, all these forms you got to fill out. And are they perfect? Hell no. There's so much fraud going on. It's crazy. I'm writing a book about it, so I'm paying a lot of attention. But if you think the regulated markets are bad, I mean, imagine the unregulated ones, right? Where there's no disclosure, where you have no idea. You know, these coins, you'll go on... You can look at some websites and you'll see who actually owns the majority of these coins. Mm-hmm. They could be like 10 wallets, 10 wallet addresses control 90% of the supply. I mean, what are we talking about? You know, that's such a tell. That's obviously going to give over to wash trading and market manipulation, things like that. And regular people are not aware. They're hearing from social media, from their friends, you know, hey, I made a bunch of money in crypto. Hey, you should buy it too. And then they buy and, you know, they lose their money, or they can't get the money out, or, you know, it's a recipe for fraud.
So it sounds like this is pretty straightforward. Just have the SEC regulate these crypto securities, and then have the Fed create a digital currency for anybody who actually wants an actual digital currency, which I could see a lot of benefits to aside from that. If you could actually kind of cut credit card, you know, processors out of, you know, stop making 7-Eleven pay so much money.
Yep.
To Visa and MasterCard, and just let them use the Fed. If you would let regular people just set up accounts at the Fed, and the Fed would also then have a lot more control over money supply, because they could monkey around a little bit with individual rates that they either charged on credit or gave to savings accounts.
Yeah.
Instead of having to like take a gigantic hammer, like they keep doing, you know, this week with another 75 basis point interest rate hike, that's such a blunt weapon.
Yeah.
Like, this would give them a lot more nuance throughout the field. So it sounds like if you do those two things, crypto would have nowhere to run, really.
Yeah. Sounds plausible to me. And I think not only that, but you'd actually have, like, as you're pointing out, quite a lot of upside potentially. You know, you could fine tune a lot of the stimulus measures. If you went back to March of 2020 and you imagine the Fed had a system like a CBDC or something with more direct access for regular people, then the Fed could get the money to the people that really need it much quicker, and could also potentially cut out a lot of fraud. You've seen they've actually, the DOJ has set up fraud task forces in exciting cities like Sacramento to deal with fraud that came out of the pandemic stimulus measures, which were, you know, the fraud there is potentially one of the biggest frauds other than crypto in history, mm-hmm. because you turn on this spigot of trillions of dollars and you only need a small percentage of that to be fraud for it to be a lot of money. And you could potentially cut that down significantly with issuing some sort of CBDC. I think the future is actually potentially very bright in this area, but ironically enough, not only will it not involve blockchain most likely, but it also spelled the death of crypto.
And then we could go back to making aluminum outside of Austin.
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, at least it's a thing that you can use.
Yeah.
You know,
we need aluminum.
I know.
And a lot of craft beer getting bought.
That's right.
So, well, Ben, thanks so much for joining me. This has all been really helpful.
Thanks, Ryan. I really appreciate it. Quite honored to speak to you. And I really love the podcast. And thanks very much.
And a reminder for people, the book is called Easy Money, and it'll be out next year, published by Abrams Press, written with Jacob Silverman, and also check out his their great dispatch from El Salvador from July of this past year.
Producer Zach here. Quick note before the credits. We reached out to Tether and Binance for comment regarding this show. As a publication, we hadn't heard back from them.
That was Ben McKenzie, and that's our show. Deconstructed is a production of First Look Media and The Intercept. Our producer is Zach Young. Laura Flynn is our supervising producer. The show was mixed by William Stanton. Our theme music was composed by Bart Warshaw. Roger Hodge is The Intercept's editor-in-chief. And I'm Ryan Grimm, D.C. Bureau Chief of The Intercept. If you'd like to support our work, go to theintercept.com/give. Your donation, no matter what the amount, makes a real difference. And if you enjoy this podcast, be sure to also check out Intercepted as well as Murderville, which is now in its second season. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show so you can hear it every week. And please do go leave us a rating or a review. It helps people find the show. If you want to give us additional feedback, email us at podcasts@theintercept.com. Thanks so much. See you soon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.